China has a very strong interest in the war ending in Afghanistan.
And that could be one reason China is scheduled to host peace talks with the Taliban. It's Thursday, October 24th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also coming your way tonight and today, the Philippines aligns itself with a country that is not China, the U.S., or Russia. The Hong Kong government makes another offer aimed at appeasing protesters in that city. It is all on today's VOA Asia. A new round of intra-Afghan peace talks will be held in China next week, raising hopes for renewed negotiations even as violence continued to surge in Afghanistan's 18-year war. The talks, revealed by Taliban spokesman Suhail Shaheen, are planned for October 28th and 29th. It would be the first meeting between Taliban and prominent Afghans from Kabul since a July round held in Doha, where the Taliban maintains a political office. Monday, the U.S. State Department said its peace envoy, Zalmay Khalilzad, started a fresh round of talks with European, NATO, and U.N. allies about ending the war. For nearly a year, Khalilzad led the first direct U.S. talks with the Taliban. However, in September, just as a deal deemed imminent, President Trump declared the prospect dead after attacks in the Afghan capital killed more than a dozen people, including a U.S. soldier. Joining us on VOA Asia is Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Washington-based Wilson Center. Michael, welcome. How did these talks end up being scheduled for China?
Well, you know, it's the story of China and its role in Afghanistan and its interactions with the Taliban is quite interesting. This will not be the first time that there have been engagements between the Taliban and China. China, over the last 2 years, has very quietly engaged with Taliban representatives. China has a very strong interest in the war ending in Afghanistan. China is building this Belt and Road Initiative, as you know, this huge transport corridor across the road. And for it to succeed, it's going to have to pass through Afghanistan in some way. And obviously, it's hard to, you know, be building roads and infrastructure in a country that's at war. So China has tried to do what it can to increase the likelihood that there can be some type of launch of a peace and reconciliation process leading to an end to the war. And so that's really why China in recent years has reached out to the Taliban and tried to help convince them that it would be the right thing to do to agree to talks with not just the United States, but many players. And in this particular case, Beijing is going to try to enable the Taliban to launch this broader intra-Afghan dialogue in which you can have efforts to build a consensus among the Afghan people for what the proper path forward is to get to a peaceful outcome.
So I take it that an official delegation from Kabul will not be part of these talks. Is that correct?
That's as I understand it, yes. And, you know, the Taliban has been pretty consistent that it will not be willing to participate in any type of intra-Afghan dialogue at which you have government officials. It's sort of suggested, the Taliban has, that it would be willing to have present government officials if they're there in their private capacity. Now, what that means exactly is not clear, but I think particularly in this case, given that, as you know, there was just an election in Afghanistan some weeks ago and the results haven't been announced, so the government is really a lame duck anyway. So I really don't think that the Taliban would have any interest in there being any type of Afghan government official there.
What about the U.S. government? Does this write the U.S. out of these talks or not?
Well, I think it is interesting that China and a number of other countries that have tried to facilitate these talks with the Taliban, these are all countries that are rivals with the U.S. You know, Russia has hosted some talks like these. Iran has as well. So it's almost like you have these efforts on the part of Afghanistan's neighbors, those that don't get along with the U.S., to try to sort of undercut the U.S.'s own efforts to launch and in the current context, relaunch some type of talks with the Taliban. I think that it really should be seen as a good thing. The U.S. should see this as a good thing that China is meeting with the Taliban, because I think it's important for any actor out there that's willing to try to do whatever is necessary to incentivize the Taliban to be willing to sit down and hold negotiations. I mean, anything is better than the war at this point. However, the U.S. government is a strategic rival of Beijing's, and it's not going to like anything that China is doing that may seem to be competing with what the United States is trying to do. And of course, in this case, it's the fact that the U.S. is also trying to get the Taliban to the table to relaunch this talks process that's been on hold for almost 2 months now.
Michael Kugelman is Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Washington-based Wilson Center for Scholars. He is one of those scholars. As always, Michael, thank you. The Philippines has agreed to strengthen defense ties with India, an increasingly significant Western ally in Asia, as part of its accumulation of foreign support in case fragile ties with China suddenly break down. Last week, the presidents of India and the Philippines decided to work more closely together on defense and security in light of what the presidential office in Manila called a fast-changing geopolitical landscape in the Asia-Pacific region. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte welcomed India's role in a Philippine program to upgrade defense, the presidential office said in a statement Saturday after a visit by Indian President Ramnath Kovind. Duterte, despite warming up to China after taking office in 2016, is now seeking foreign ties elsewhere, fearing pressure from Beijing on a maritime sovereignty dispute over the South China Sea. Alan Chong is Associate Professor at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies in Singapore.
He cannot be sure of China's one-way goodwill. He thought he had China as a friend. Then I think he realized that behind the smiles and the pageantry and all the economic deals, China was actually continuing to militarize its occupied islands in the South China Sea.
India has its own grievances with China, has been working with other countries, including the United States, to check Beijing's maritime expansion. Despite Duterte's efforts to foster a friendship with Beijing, with China pledging $24 billion in aid and investment to the Philippines in 2016, hundreds of Chinese vessels stirred up concerns after passing near Philippine-held islets in the seas contested Spratly Archipelago in April. And in early June, a Chinese fishing boat sank a Filipino vessel near the disputed seas Recto Bank, raising questions about a possible ramming incident. Duterte is now looking for closer relations with powerful third countries, using China as a gambit, according to Stephen Nagy, a senior associate politics and international studies professor at the International Christian University in Tokyo.
I think it's the Philippines really fishing for lots of different assistance and using China as the bait. Unofficially, the Chinese are probably not going to be happy that India has increased their relationship with the Philippines, and they probably will read it as the Philippines basically milking every cow rather than really forging strong and enduring relationship with China.
Duterte visited Russia earlier this month for talks that analysts say could generate arms sales. He's made efforts to cozy up to Washington this year after a strain in relations in 2016. And in May, the president made his third visit to Japan, which, like India, is working with Washington and other Western countries to check China's maritime expansion. Brunei, China, Malaysia, Taiwan, Vietnam, and the Philippines claim all or parts of the South China Sea. China claims 90% of the waterway as its own, and it has taken a military lead there over the past decade. India, located west of the Indo-Chinese Peninsula, does not claim any part of the South China Sea, but in September it held military drills with Japan and the United States. Even though the drills took place outside the disputed sea, India showed support of a rule-based order in Asian seas instead of giving credence to Beijing's claims. That, according to Jay Batangabakal, international maritime affairs professor at the University of the Philippines. India's East Asia policy that calls for stronger economic ties with fast-growing Southeast Asia, including the Philippines, would put further weight behind China's rivals in the maritime dispute. But Batangabakal says these ties may not be enough.
India itself is also, in a way, still exploring what it can do in Southeast Asia in general, based on its Act East policy. But in terms of substance, it's also been not moving as fast as, say, China.
Our thanks to VOA's Ralph Jennings in Taipei for the story. Thanks for being with us. Hong Kong's legislature Wednesday formally killed the extradition bill that sparked 4 months of anti-government protest on the same day that the murder suspect at the center of the issue was released from jail in Hong Kong and said he plans to turn himself in to Taiwanese authorities. But protesters and opposition legislators say this is a small concession that will not lead them to back down from the 5 demands they seek from Hong Kong's government. VOA's Anita Powell has the story from Hong Kong.
The man in the middle of Hong Kong's political maelstrom said little upon his release from prison Wednesday, the same day that legislators formally rescinded the bill that mired the city in 4 months of anti-government protests. 20-year-old Chan Tong-kai inadvertently set off 4 months of anti-government protests in his hometown, Hong Kong, when he violently killed his pregnant girlfriend in Taiwan last year. The semi-autonomous Chinese city cited his case in February in proposing legislation that would allow Hong Kongers like Chan to be extradited to China for trial. That lit a fire in this densely populated city, which since its handover from British rule back to China in 1997, was allowed by Beijing to operate under a one-country, two-systems agreement. This proposed extradition bill, many residents felt, was a step too far towards Beijing. And so the protests started in June, and violent clashes ensued between protesters and police. And the demands morphed into something much bigger than this piece of legislation. The city's chief executive, Carrie Lam, suspended the bill in June. But the demonstrations continued, with protesters in this leaderless movement shaping 5 demands to their government. Those include universal suffrage, an investigation of police violence during the protests, amnesties for protesters, and the full official withdrawal of the extradition bill. On Wednesday, they got one of those demands, when members of the city's legislative council officially withdrew the bill. But activist Lung Kwok Hung told VOA that it is not enough.
I think it's too little and too late. The 5 demands from the Hong Kong people should be dealt with. So Carrie Lam needs to tackle the rest of the demands, and she needs to deliver the leadership in order to make the whole community remember, those things should not be done again. And she needs to deliver a roadmap and timetable to solve the problem of Hong Kong. I don't think the Hong Kong people will stop protesting just because of this late and little concession.
Immediately after the bill was formally withdrawn Wednesday afternoon, opposition lawmakers called on the city's security secretary to resign. He did not reply to their calls. Lawmaker Raymond Chan told VOA that he, too, would not ease up on his demands within the halls of the legislative body.
It is not important. We will still give pressure on Carrie Lam and the secretary of the government, force them to reply the 5 main demands of the society.
Chan, the murder suspect, has also inadvertently set off a turf war between Hong Kong and Taiwan. He indicated Wednesday that he would willingly surrender to Taipei, where he faces murder charges. But Taiwan's leadership has asked Hong Kong to try him. They have refused, arguing that Taiwanese authorities have jurisdiction. On Tuesday, Taiwan's president, Tsai Ing-wen, lamented the situation. The Hong Kong government refuses to exercise its jurisdiction, she says. This leads to its own fellow victimized citizen failing to receive justice. If this happened in another country and the Hong Kong government adopted this attitude, every country's government would feel bothered. On Wednesday, Chan emerged from prison in Hong Kong, where he served 19 months after being convicted for using his dead girlfriend's credit cards after her death. He looked meek and contrite. He stopped by the cameras, bowed deeply, and said softly, "To the society and to Hong Kongers, I can only say sorry." Meanwhile, protests are set to enter a 21st week. Anita Powell, VOA News, Hong Kong.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Keith Holmes, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our team of Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, and our interns, Hai Young and Afra. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day.